The U.S. debt is now at $37 trillion. Let that sink in. You've heard that number before, but you probably tuned it out because it sounds like something that lives in Washington and doesn't touch you. That's the problem. People hear debt to GDP or $37 trillion, and it's just background noise, like a weather report for another country. But this isn't just some line on a government spreadsheet. It's tied to everything in your life, whether you notice it or not. Gas, groceries, rent, the cost of borrowing money for a car or a house, the interest on your credit card. When the government's debt grows, the cost of carrying that debt grows too. And when interest payments start swallowing up $1 trillion a year, that money isn't going to fixing roads, funding schools, or keeping Medicare solvent. It's going to creditors, some of them right here in the US, but a lot of them in places like Japan and China. You'll hear this other term thrown around, debt to GDP. It sounds technical, but it's not. GDP is just the country's paycheck. It's the total value of everything we produce in a year. Debt to GDP compares what we owe to what we earn. Right now, we owe the equivalent of our entire annual paycheck. Imagine if you brought home $60,000 a year, but had a $60,000 debt on top of your normal bills. You could throw every single dollar at it, and you'd still have nothing left to live on. That's where the United States is right now, except we're not even paying it down. We're making interest payments and borrowing more on top of that. And every time we do it, we're betting that people will keep lending to us because the US dollar is still the world's reserve currency. If you want the full story, how we went from the gold standard to Nixon, to Reagan, to printing money and buying our own bonds, see our US dollar and inflation article. But this is about now, and now is different. $37 trillion is a record high. The debt to GDP ratio is at 100%. Both parties say it's a problem when they're in the minority, and both keep adding to it when they're in charge. And if you think it doesn't matter to you, wait until the ripple hits, because it always does. Before Trump ever walked in, the debt was already climbing. The Great Recession cracked the floor, the government flooded the system to keep it from collapsing, and the wars were still burning cash. Revenue fell when the economy tanked, spending jumped to stop the freefall, and the gap in between got covered with borrowing. That is how you go from around $10 trillion at the end of the 2000s to the high teens by the time Obama is wrapping up. The key point, by 2016, we were already flirting with a debt to GDP ratio that said, we owe about a year's paycheck. We were not in a pay it down mindset. We were in a keep the lights on and grow out of it mindset. Trump's first term starts with strong optics. Low unemployment, markets humming, a sense that the machine is working again. But even with the wind at our back, the red ink kept spreading. Congress lifted spending caps, defense went up, and the tax code got lighter in places without matching cuts on the outflow side. Then 2020 hit and blew a hole through every spreadsheet in town. COVID relief was not optional. The government backstopped households and businesses with trillions. That is how you go from the high teens to the mid-20s fast. People can argue ideology all day. The ledger does not care. The line still moved up. Then Biden steps in, and we go from emergency response to long-term bets. What that means is this. First came continued relief. More stimulus checks, business support, basic keep-the-lights-on aid. But then Congress passed three major investment packages that were supposed to move us forward. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of November 2021 was pitched as a once-in-a-generation rebuild of bridges, roads, water systems, power grids, and broadband. The CBO says it added over $340 billion to the deficit, or nearly $400 billion when you factor in how it raises baseline transportation spending. So yeah, it's investment, but it still added hundreds of billions to the tab. Next came the CHIPS and Science Act in August 2022, designed to bring semiconductor manufacturing back to the US, build labs, and strengthen supply chains. The CBO put its price tag at $48 billion over 5 years and $79 billion by 2031, mostly front-loaded. Again, forward-looking idea, but still a deficit hit. Then the Inflation Reduction Act, also passed in August 2022. supposed to fight climate change, lower drug costs, and reduce deficits. The nonpartisan CBO scored it as $238 billion in deficit reduction over a decade, but that's assuming everything goes as planned. Other estimates put the long-run reduction at closer to $175 billion. Not zero, but not huge either, especially compared to the dollars spent in the other two bills. So, stack those bills. Infrastructure adds hundreds of billions. CHIPS adds tens of billions. IRA knocks down a couple hundred. Then pile on the interest rates rising, making every debt rollover more expensive. And you're borrowing on top of borrowing. That's how Washington goes from pandemic response to $37 trillion by 2025 in debt, all within a few years. Now we're in Trump's second term, and the big, beautiful bill is the new lever being pulled. Strip away the politics, and it's this: a stack of policies that move cash flows. If it cuts taxes in some areas without equal cuts in spending, the government brings in less money and the deficit gets bigger. If it ramps up enforcement, adds tariffs, and launches big industrial projects without paying for them up front, spending goes up and the deficit gets bigger. If it tries to do both, cut here, spend there, you're still leaning on the same credit card unless the economy grows fast enough to cover the difference. Supporters say the bill will pay for itself through growth or savings, and maybe some of that happens, but the ledger only asks one question: did the gap between what's coming in and what's going out get bigger or smaller? That's it. Think about it like your own household budget. At the start of the month, you look at your paycheck. If your total bills, groceries, gas, and extras add up to more than what you're bringing in, you've got three choices: cut spending, find more income, or put it on a credit card and deal with it later. If you choose the credit card route, your debt grows, and so does the interest you pay every month. Washington works the same way, except the credit card is the bond market, and the interest is over $1 trillion a year. Here is why this matters for regular people who are tired of the noise. When Washington runs bigger deficits, Treasury has to sell more bonds. When there are more bonds, and the market asks for a higher yield to hold them, rates stay elevated. Elevated rates show up everywhere: car loans, mortgages, credit cards, small business lines of credit. Elevated rates also jack up the government's own interest bill, which then eats a larger share of the budget, and when interest plus Social Security plus Medicare take more of the pie, everything else fights for scraps: roads, schools, research, even parts of the military. That is $37 trillion in real life. That is gas, groceries, rent, payroll, and whether your city fixes the bridge this year or tells you to wait. Some people say, well, why not just have the Fed drop interest rates so everything's cheaper? Sounds easy, right? But interest rates are basically the price of borrowing money. If that price is low, people borrow more. They use those loans to buy houses, cars, start businesses, or just shop more. And when everybody's out there spending at the same time, but there's only so much stuff to buy, prices go up. That's inflation. Think of it like this: you've got 10 gallons of milk on the shelf. If 20 people rush in to buy milk, that last gallon suddenly becomes more valuable. The store can raise the price because demand is higher than supply. Money works the same way. When there's too much of it chasing too few goods, the price of those goods rises. So if the Fed slashes rates while the government's still running big deficits, it's like stepping on the gas in a car that's already overheating. You might get a short burst of speed, but you're going to blow the engine, meaning prices spike, the dollar loses buying power, and eventually the Fed has to slam on the brakes and raise rates even higher than before. This article is about the bill coming due in a higher rate world: pre-Trump, first-term Trump, Biden, and now second-term Trump with the big, beautiful bill. Four stages of the same story. We spend more than we take in, and we argue about who caused it while the meter keeps running. The difference now is simple. The interest line is growing faster than the patience line. That is not cable news spin. That is math. If you strip the politics out of it, the debt keeps climbing because three lines on the budget never stop moving up: interest, Social Security, and Medicare. Those are the big automatic checks. Everything else, defense, education, infrastructure, is the stuff we fight about, but it's not what's blowing the debt wide open year after year. Interest is the fastest mover now. This year, the U.S. will spend over $1 trillion just on interest. And because interest rates have been higher the last couple years, every time old debt rolls over and new debt gets issued, it's more expensive to carry. That's like refinancing your mortgage every year at a higher rate and wondering why you're short at the end of the month. Social Security is next. It's not a mystery why. We've got 10,000 baby boomers retiring every single day. The payroll taxes coming in aren't enough to cover the checks going out, so the difference gets pulled from the trust fund, and when that runs low, the gap goes right on the national tab. Medicare works the same way. More retirees mean more people using it, and healthcare costs grow faster than inflation. The math is automatic. You can't flip a switch and slow it down without cutting benefits, which no politician wants to do. Then there's the fact we haven't run a surplus since 2001. Every single year since then, we've spent more than we've taken in. Doesn't matter who's in office. The last time we were actually paying debt down, it was under Clinton in the late 90s, when the economy was roaring, tax revenue was high, and spending was relatively restrained. Those days are gone. Now here's where this hits you directly. When the government spends more than it takes in, it borrows the difference by selling treasury bonds. Investors buy those bonds because they're considered safe. But when the supply of bonds keeps going up and interest rates are already high, the government has to offer higher yields to get buyers. That higher yield keeps rates high across the economy for mortgages, for car loans, for credit cards, for business lines of credit. High rates mean you pay more to borrow, which means less money in your pocket. High rates also slow down businesses from expanding or hiring, which means fewer jobs and smaller raises. And remember, that trillion we're spending on interest, that's $1 trillion not going to repair the highway you drive every day, not going into your kids' school, not going to disaster relief when the next storm hits. It's not going to police budgets, veterans' health care, or small business programs. It's going straight to people who hold our debt. This is the part that gets lost when you just hear $37 trillion on the news. It's not about whether you personally write a check to the Treasury. It's about how the cost of carrying that debt shows up in every bill you pay, every service you use, and every raise you don't get. The national debt is a headline for Washington. The ripple is everything in your day-to-day life. Here's what I keep hearing when I flip channels. One side says the debt is exploding because the other side spends too much. The other side says the debt is exploding because the first side keeps cutting taxes. They're both selling pieces of the truth, and both are leaving out the part where they also fed the meter. The ledger does not care about team colors. The ledger only cares about cash in, cash out, and the rate we're paying to carry the balance. As of this week, the total tab is just under $37 trillion. That's the official Treasury count, not a TV graphic. Let's deal with the loudest new variable first. The bill Trump signed on July 4th, 2025, the Big Beautiful Bill, now has a formal score from CBO. Bottom line, about $4.1 trillion added to the deficit over 10 years, with roughly $718 billion more in interest costs than earlier estimates because borrowing itself gets pricier when you increase the supply of debt and markets demand a higher yield. That's not a pundit's take, that's the budget office in black and white. Supporters argue growth will offset more than CBO expects. Fine, let's watch the cash flow. But the current score says bigger deficits and higher interest costs, which is the opposite direction from paying it down. Now zoom out. People keep asking, if the debt to GDP ratio is about 100%, why do I care? Here's why. A higher ratio with rising interest rates means the interest line eats more of the federal budget every year. So what's the practical translation for people who don't live on C-SPAN? Bigger deficits mean Treasury sells more bonds. More bonds at a time of sticky inflation and higher rates means investors ask for higher yields. Higher treasury yields feed directly into mortgage rates, car notes, credit cards, and small business lines of credit. When your payment goes up, you buy less. When businesses face pricier credit, they hire slower and expand less. Meanwhile, the federal government's own interest bill climbs again next year, and again the year after, because old debt keeps rolling over at today's higher rates. That's the pipeline from $37 trillion to gas, groceries, rent, payroll, not because you write a check to pay the national debt, but because the price of money you use every day is pegged to the same market that prices America's debt. That whole system runs on something most people never think about: bonds and yields. A bond is basically an IOU the government sells to borrow money. You give the government a set amount now, and they promise to pay you back later with a little extra on top. That extra is the interest. The yield is the actual return you get for lending that money. Think of it like the interest rate on a savings account. Except here, you're the one lending the money to the US government. Here's where it matters. When the government sells more bonds because it's running a bigger deficit, investors have choices. If they're not impressed with what the US is paying, they can put their money somewhere else. To keep investors interested, the government has to sweeten the deal, meaning it offers a higher yield. That's just a fancy way of saying they promise to pay more interest. If last month they were paying $3 back on every $100 loaned, now maybe it's $4. Higher yields sound good if you're the investor, but they push borrowing costs up everywhere else. That's because treasury yields are like the anchor for other interest rates: mortgages, car loans, credit cards, business loans. When that anchor goes up, the whole ship rises with it. So when you hear yields are rising, don't think of it as some abstract Wall Street number. Think of it as the reason your mortgage payment jumped, or why your small business line of credit suddenly costs more every month. And here's where someone in the back will yell, "Well, what if we just don't pay? It's not like America's going to disappear if we stiff a few investors, right?" Wrong. Picture Black Friday 1929, but in the modern world where every piece of your life runs on credit. The moment the US says, "We're not paying," the trust that props up our entire financial system snaps. That's called a default, and it's the financial equivalent of lighting the credit score of the entire United States on fire. Borrowing costs wouldn't just rise, they'd rocket overnight. The dollar would nosedive, foreign governments and investors would dump US bonds in a panic, and Wall Street would go into freefall. It wouldn't stop there. Retirement funds tied to government bonds would take huge losses. Businesses would see credit lines vanish or triple in cost. Layoffs would sweep through every sector as companies slammed the brakes. Mortgage rates, car loans, and credit cards would spike within days. International trade would seize up as nobody wanted to deal in a currency they couldn't trust. And unlike the Great Depression, when the damage rippled slowly by train and telegraph, today it would hit at internet speed. By the time you woke up the next morning, it wouldn't just be Wall Street in crisis, it would be your street. Understand this: right now, even the experts don't agree on where the debt goes from here. The White House's own forecast says we can hold the debt around where it is, just under 100% of the economy, and maybe bring it down a little if the economy grows faster than expected. But independent budget groups see it differently. They think it will keep climbing, 100% of the economy this year, 102% next year, and pushing into the 120% range by the early 2030 if nothing changes. You don't need to take a side. Just ask yourself which of those futures your mortgage, your business, or your city could actually handle. If you take away the slogans, the finger pointing, and the political theater, it's really simple. The government is bringing in less money than it's spending, and the cost of carrying the debt we already have is going up. That's it. We're not talking about complicated formulas. It's the same problem a family has when their bills are bigger than their paycheck and their credit card interest keeps climbing. On TV, the fight is about who you want to blame. One party says it's spending, the other says it's tax cuts. In real life, the fight is about whether you can afford the price of money that comes with living like this for another 10 years. when the government's debt stays high and keeps growing, it holds those rates higher than they would otherwise be. That means less money in your pocket, fewer raises, slower growth for businesses, and less funding left over for the things you actually use: roads, schools, public safety. When the U.S. borrows more, it issues more treasury bonds. Those bonds are the benchmark for almost every type of borrowing in America. If the yield on a 10-year treasury goes up, mortgage rates follow. That's why a $350,000 home loan that might have cost you $1,500 a month in 2021 can cost you $2,300 or more now. That's not just inflation, that's the price of money moving higher, and it's tied directly to how much debt the government is floating. It's the same story with car loans. Back in 2020, you could get a new car loan for about 4% interest. Now it's closer to 7%. On a $40,000 car, that's not just a small bump, that's hundreds more every month and thousands more by the time you've paid it off. And that's why we're now hearing that a $1,000 a month car payment has become the new normal for a lot of people. Think about that. $1,000 every month just to park something in your driveway. Credit cards are no better. The national average interest rate is over 21%, the highest it's ever been. That means if you're carrying a balance, you're paying more in interest every month than you ever have before. And it's all connected. When the base cost of borrowing in the economy, the rate the government has to pay to borrow, goes up and stays up, every other rate you deal with goes up too. That's how Washington's debt shows up in your driveway and in your wallet. For businesses, especially small businesses, higher rates mean delaying expansion, slowing hiring, and holding off on raises. That trickles down to paychecks. If a business owner's line of credit now costs 9% instead of 4%, that extra cost has to be made up somewhere, and it's usually in payroll or pricing. Then there's the budget squeeze on the government itself. In 2024, we spent roughly $880 billion just on interest. That's more than we spent on Medicare. By the end of this decade, the CBO project's interest could be the single largest item in the federal budget, bigger than defense, bigger than Social Security. When that happens, every new dollar coming into the Treasury gets fought over by programs that actually provide services and the bondholders who expect their interest checks on time. That's the real ripple effect. Debt on this scale pushes up the cost of money for everyone, which raises the cost of living. It chokes off room in the federal budget for things people actually use. And because so much of our debt is held overseas, Japan, China, the UK, and other foreign investors own trillions in treasuries, a rising share of your tax dollars leaves the country before it ever touches an American project or paycheck. This isn't about whether you like Trump or Biden, whether you believe in tax cuts or social spending. This is about the math we all live with. $37 trillion is the headline. The real story is the interest rate on your next loan, the size of your next raise, and whether the bridge down the street gets fixed or stays on the to-do list another year. The dollar gave us decades of breathing room. We used that time to build, to spend, to promise, and to dodge the hard choices. Now the bill is showing up every day in ways most people don't connect to Washington's balance sheet. The payment on a car that used to cost hundreds now costs $1,000. The mortgage you can't qualify for even with good credit. The raise your company can't give because credit is too expensive. And here's the part nobody in power likes to admit. Both parties talk about the debt like it's a moral crisis, but neither one stops spending. If people in Washington really cared about America's future the way they claim, this wouldn't be a campaign soundbite. It would be a national project. Not immigration, not ICE raids, not culture wars. Because if the people we owe ever call our bluff and demand their money back, we don't get to argue about policy. We pay or we collapse. This isn't about party loyalty. It's about arithmetic. $37 trillion in debt is more than a headline. It's a shadow on the next decade of your life. You can blame whoever you want for how we got here, but the reality is the same. Either we start closing the gap between what comes in and what goes out, or the cost of money will keep deciding that gap for us. The debt won't wait for an election cycle, neither will the ripple. One story, one truth, one ripple at a time. This is the Ripple Effect, powered by the Truth Project.